Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowring. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene. Every Friday at 12:30, we sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these folks. The conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today, we're talking to Derek Guthrie. Welcome, Derek, to Zero Hour. Thanks for joining us. Derek, I guess we can start out by talking about you being the publisher of the New Art Examiner. From what dates to what dates did you do that?
It started in October 74.
Uh-huh.
And we stayed with it to approximately 2002, I think.
Really? So it was a long run.
It was a long run.
Yeah. We were talking a little bit about sort of the impetus for doing this, the beginnings of this and why you did this. And I guess the first thing I was kind of curious about is why did you call it New Art Examiner?
That's the best name we could think of.
As opposed to Old Art Examiner.
As opposed to Old Art Examiner.
Right.
When I wanted to call it the New Art Gazette, I mean, that would have been nagged. Others wouldn't go with
it. But
that.
It says the independent voice of the visual arts.
Yes.
So what made you say that?
Well, there's a history to how we decided to start it. And when I say we, I mean me and my late wife, who was a woman called Jane Adams Allen. It's difficult history. In fact, I'm going to be giving lectures on it for the first time in the near future.
On the magazine itself?
Yes. And the issues of criticism and uh-huh. cultural commentary in America. Jane and I had been joint art critic for the Chicago Tribune.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to be there in unusual circumstances. But the point was that the Chicago art establishment was very, very unhappy about that.
Unhappy about?
Us getting to be the...
The art critic?
Yeah. And actually, we weren't looking for it. It was a funny accident. And we did a great job, and we worked for 18 months, and we built up a big following.
Why didn't they like it?
Well, they had other people in mind that they had nominated.
Aha. Okay.
And, you know, Chicago, though it's a big city, it's a very small city. The internetworking of the power establishment in Chicago is very tight. And it's
right.
a city that is, well, heck, you know, it's been a dynasty now of dailies
yeah.
for
yeah,
a
dailies
very long
forever.
Time.
Right, right.
And it doesn't change. I mm-hmm. mean, it's Midwest. Mm-hmm. And so
they had a pretty clear idea of what art they wanted and what art the
oh,
kind of criticism they wanted.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay.
And we took the position... if Chicago wants to be a major art town, it mustn't be a one-horse town. Mm-hmm. It has to have diversity. And we realized that, we knew that New York supported a diversity of art.
And what time period are we talking about here? Is this early 80s?
No.
It's
69, 70, 71, 70.
Oh, okay, that's right. Okay. Yeah. This was long before the magazine.
Well, just a year or two.
Oh, okay.
Say
right.
2 years before.
Okay.
Or 1 year before. Anyway, the point was that Jane and I had lived on many European... Between us, we'd lived on a number of capital cities.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that there had to be a diversity of thought and art production. And it couldn't be managed in the way that Chicago likes to manage things. Chicago has done very well by being a one-horse political town.
Right.
But that doesn't mean it has to be a one-horse cultural town.
Uh-huh.
And so that was our position. And we... So the Trib fired us and wouldn't give us a reason. We were only stringers, and they didn't have to. But we never missed a deadline, and they stopped editing our copy. It was just sheer political pressure. I mean, art political pressure, because we wouldn't wave the flag for what Chicago hierarchy was supporting.
And what were they supporting at the time?
Well, it's called the Chicago Imagists, or the Hairy Who, were the last manifestation of it. which was a kind of campy, inward-turned, funky art. They got some of their ideas from the West Coast.
Right.
And it basically, it was campy and fundamentally anti-intellectual. But we knew there were other traditions in Chicago. I mean, you know, Mahody Nagy went there for the new Bauhaus, for goodness sake.
Mm-hmm, right.
And there's all that wonderful architecture, and that produces a very overwhelming aesthetic reality.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys are into cartoons and hemorrhoid advertisements and things like that. And we said, well, you know, there's more to it.
There's more to it than this,
yeah,
guys.
Okay. So we couldn't.
So you got fired,
so we
right?
So got fired from the chair.
Okay.
And it was pretty bad. I mean, there's not much future when you have a well-known position and you lose it.
Right.
So we went to New York, and we sold ourselves to Art News as writers, and, mm-hmm. and they were delighted. And the Chicago images were going to the San Paolo Biennale that year. They were representing America. The generals had taken over Brazil a few years before, and mm-hmm. a number of other mm-hmm. liberal countries went sending to that. So there's a bit of a background to it, but nevertheless, you know, Chicago didn't want to bother with that.
Right, right.
This is an opportunity for international success.
Mm-hmm.
So we wrote our article, and we sent it off to Art News, and the editor of Art News rang up Jane, I was in London at the time, and he said, this is great stuff, that's exactly what I want, we're going to run it a month early. So we thought, great, we now have an identity as writers.
Yeah.
And then a phone call came, and it said, did you footnote your article? So, well, as it was our first time
right.
in the big time,
right.
it was footnoted to death because we were so nervous. I think there's more footnotes than article when it came to it. Anyway, so off the footnotes went. and
it's a lot of small type.
And, yeah, precisely. And anyway, then another call came and said, can you send biographies of the artists? And by the way, we're not running it a month early. So we got...
What was going on?
Well, so it was sent off the mail. And anyway, then the check arrived in the mail saying we're not going to run it, and they didn't even pay a kill fee.
Really?
And we were told later that the advertising man had told a number of people that we were lifted off the galleys 3 days before publication because of pressure from Chicago galleries
But this was in New York, right?
Yeah, but New York accepts advertising from the regions.
Sure.
So,
sure, okay, okay.
So, okay. So we were dead. That was it. And so
are you able to talk about what you think it was that caused such consternation on their part?
Yeah, because they tried to kill us before.
Well, I know, but
successfully.
But why?
Why? Because Chicago.
I mean, were you dismissive of the work? Were you?
No, we weren't dismissive. No, not at all. No, it wasn't a question of our attitude. In fact, the very funny thing was, I was in London when this happened. And Jane sent me the article, and I went to Studio International, and it was published next week.
Wow.
And so we fell on the wrong side of Chicago. I can only call it gangster politics, and
right.
I mean it.
Yeah.
And the Museum of Contemporary.
Talk about strange bedfellows. You wouldn't think the politicians would give a damn.
No, well... Chicago's a very tight culture.
Yeah.
It's the city of daily.
Right.
And it's been the city of daily for years.
So they are talking to each other.
Well, they speak the same language.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if they're art or not. I mean, look, it was Studs Terkel who came up with the expression, you're either for us or against us. and he was writing about Chicago, and
yeah.
he was writing about precinct politics.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, unfortunately, it's now world politics because that lovely expression as how to run.
But, see, I thought George Bush came up with that.
No, he didn't. It was Studs Terkel. And Studs Terkel is impeachable in Chicago.
Who I love, by the way.
Yeah. But he said we have an incapacitate to accept criticism.
Mm.
So Terkel knows what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm very pleased to have his words.
Mm.
And so, and this was in a Time Life book written about the heartland. I mean, mm-hmm. this was not an esoteric thing.
Right, right.
Well, the point is that Chicago had this enormous growth. Great industrial production, but it came out of the prairies, so it's isolated.
Mm.
And Chicago is an isolated city.
Mm-hmm.
But the fusion of the Midwest fear of the other,
mm-hmm.
which is what McCarthy had, because he came mm-hmm. from up the road, mm-hmm. which was Wisconsin.
Right.
So that kind of heartland fear, maybe it's in true in Ohio today, that heartland fear has an expression inside the so-called sophistication of an urban culture, which is what Chicago is.
Right.
Chicago is it has great institutions, but the culture is basically second city. It's a second city complex, and that's its own name for itself.
Yeah. So the new. It's not the new, but New Art Examiner.
Yeah.
That grew out of your this situation,
Believe it or not. So Jane, when she heard about this business, mm-hmm. she said, "Look, there's only one way we'll ever become art writers.
Right.
We've got to become our own publisher." And this was a great act of realization, and I think it was inherited from her ancestor. We had a lot of community support because people enjoyed what we'd already written. So we put out the first edition with no money.
Yeah, I was going to say. How?
No
yeah,
money.
Yeah.
8-page newsprint,
yeah.
which everybody thought would die inside 3 months.
Uh-huh.
And through incredible dedication and also the need for an independent voice, it gradually grew.
That's an interesting word you use because it's in the subtitle. Independent voice.
Yes.
What does that mean to you? I mean, that's quite a statement.
It means you have the confidence to say what you think without thinking about other people.
Mm-hmm.
It means that you believe in your own response and you're free from any notion of social or political correctness.
Okay.
And
you think you were able to achieve that?
Well, we did.
Really? Interesting.
Because we're not ideological.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Now, we believe that discourse, and I think in a way, looking back on it, I think we were probably a bit dated. We inherited the idea of an avant-garde,
mm-hmm.
but it was not an American avant-garde. It was a European avant-garde.
And the difference being...
Well, the difference is that the European avant-garde comes out of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a cafe society then, mm-hmm. which is basically where writers, artists, and intellectuals mm-hmm. used to go. And because of the political differences between Europe and America, it was quite... You could be avant-garde in a different way because it doesn't have the implications of what it has now in America. It's a different cultural idea of freedom,
mm-hmm.
which is what mm-hmm. European politics mm-hmm. gives you, and mm-hmm. American politics doesn't give you the idea of freedom.
Right.
Because you're faced with either being a red or a blue.
Right. Really, kind of narrows it down.
That narrows it.
And, no, we got a new color now. We got purple now.
Okay.
Yeah, we're broadening.
But it comes from a time when intellectualism was regarded as a worthwhile activity.
Okay, all right.
And today...
So there was almost a moral obligation to be intellectually pure.
Well, you can't be an intellectual unless you can't be an intellectual unless you entertain the idea that discussion is more important than ideology.
Right, okay. All right. That's well said. We could end right there.
Okay.
That's great. But I want to get back to your magazine because I know this is a huge question, so maybe it'll be the last question I ask you. You can try and answer it. But what do you feel, New Art Examiner, what do you feel it accomplished?
Well, I think it was the last vestiges of an art scene that hadn't been taken over by corporations.
Mm.
And the American avant-garde in the 50s, after World War II, was centered around a kind of visionary thing, not because it was abstract expressionism, that was a manifestation of it, but it was centered around the idea of an intellectual, a free creative force, and they were centered around partisan review, which in a way was like the avant-garde in Europe, because it was intellectuals that were defining themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They weren't looking for anybody else to define them.
Right.
And after Andy Warhol in the 60s, that all stopped.
Mm-hmm.
So
what did it become, you think?
Well, it became...
Defined through the market? I mean...
Well...
I mean, that certainly was one of the... Huge influences,
it was overwhelmed by popular culture.
Yeah.
And the museums had to...
Mm-hmm.
The museums didn't manage it. I mean, this is repeated later. When we had Helms, Senator Helms,
right.
and he started the culture wars,
right.
He went after artists, mm-hmm. right? Mapplethorpe,
mm-hmm.
you know, silly idea of or obscenity or,
mm-hmm.
or offensiveness. Mm-hmm. However, the point was, if the American Museum Association, in their wisdom or courage, if they had closed ranks and if they had decided to defend art,
mm-hmm.
then Helms would never got away with it.
Well, let's talk about Mapplethorpe, because you were looking at one of the magazines that I have here.
Yeah.
And there's an interesting article that says pornography and postmodernism.
Right.
Do you remember that? Do you remember that?
Yeah. Eleanor Hartney.
Yeah, and it's kind of what you're making reference to here.
Well, I mean, I find the whole problem was that, I mean, you know, very, very simple terms, I mean, there's so much hypocrisy. I mean, Helms goes after artists. However...
Because they're immoral.
Well, because they do what they do, and he calls it immoral. It
better said, right.
Yeah, but, you know, I don't think the voyeurism of when Oprah Winfrey gets four, five, six different couples, which may be mother and daughter sharing the same boyfriend,
right.
or some whatever activity there is, and they all talk about it on a popular show, I think that is a cultural voyeurism that is allowed.
It's a form of pornography.
It's a form of pornography. And the point was that artists, as they were abandoned by the museums, they're losers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, another name for local artist is a community artist.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not successful, if you're not a superstar, you're a community artist. That's
right.
Another name for loser.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is that the point is the guys who manage the superstars, who are the museums,
right.
did
right.
not pull their weight.
Right.
So the tragedy is not that Helms went after artists, but it was the failure of nerve by our cultural institutions
mm-hmm.
that are meant to look after art. And I think that this is an example of how they have been co-opted.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is exactly the problem of today. The artist has nowhere to go.
That's interesting. So you have no interest in restarting something like this?
I'm too old. I don't. I lost so many years hustling and organizing social events and all the other things.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, you see, that you have to understand that New York was the epicenter of contemporary art.
Right.
It no longer is. Nobody outside of America is looking to New York for leadership anymore.
Right.
And, I mean, this is a fact of life. that either the art community in one way is going to think about or not think about. Mm-hmm. And I think they have to think about it, and I think they have to ask the reasons why.
So instead of artist, you have superstar.
That's right.
And or almost pop star artist. Instead
Jeff Koons, too.
Instead of truly intellectual exploration, you have product and marketability and saleability.
Yeah, but I think you can say the same for presidents.
Well, you can say the same for a lot of things. But
you can say the same for presidents.
Do you think it's over? I mean, what are you saying? Do you think there are just artists out there that are doing what they're doing, but there's just nowhere for them to go?
There's nowhere for them to go. Criticism is virtually dead now. I mean, because there's nowhere to write criticism.
Really?
I mean, the specialist art magazines who do the best they can, but you've got to understand that over 90% of their income is from advertising.
Yes.
And the point is that...
To sell the art.
Well, yeah. I mean, I quite like that advertising because for an insider, you can read how the market goes by the side of the ads. But it's like reading real estate if you're a real estate person.
You mean as a collector?
No, as a collector. It's like reading real estate ads if you know how to read them, which is fine. I don't mind that.
But do you collect art?
No, of course not.
No?
No, I wouldn't dream of collecting it.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Because I write on it.
Explain. So the objectivity that's required for you to write about would be at risk if you were...
Yeah, precisely.
But, I mean, on some emotional level...
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean, I think...
That's interesting.
And I think one of the other worst things that's happened...
So there's no art in your house?
Well, there's bits and pieces, but there's odd pieces that I've been given. But, I mean, they're minute. It's an irrelevant thing. But the other point is I'm an artist myself, but I don't exhibit. And I've been an artist all these years.
What kind of art?
Well, I use an oriental brush.
Do you?
And it's outside the normal orthodoxies of avant-gardism, though it comes out of a tradition of avant-garde.
Uh-huh.
But I don't exhibit because I think it's a waste of time.
Why?
Because I think as the art world is so managed, it's a trickle-down theory, mm-hmm. and there's no trickle-up.
Right.
And so. And I know what most people are going to say when they see it anyway, so I'm not going to get too much enlightenment from a casual viewer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to sell it, and I can't exhibit it unless I put a price.
Has this left you in a I'll use a simple word. Has this left you sad? Has this left you...
No, my friends see my art, and if they visit my house, they will see it.
Uh-huh.
But
no, I just mean seeing the art world as not being a place.
Yeah, but I believe. I really believe
for the arts. Do you think that's just unnecessary? Really?
No. You see, I believe in the avant-garde. You see, because I mean, I believe in Van Gogh, Gauguin, and Cézanne.
Mm-hmm.
And in modern day terms, they were all losers.
Right. Right.
So how you can?
So what makes a successful artist for you?
Well, you mean for me or for others?
No, I mean you. Others, I think we've already covered.
Okay. Well, I mean, successful artists make art that speaks to me.
Hmm.
But that's like what's a successful novel or successful mm-hmm. music. Mm-hmm. It's what speaks to you.
Mm-hmm.
And as I write and used to write do criticism, I'm very interested in the problem of finding words to explain what speaks to you, mm-hmm. and I think that's part of necessary discourse.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Why did you stop publishing the magazine?
Oh, we got tired and ill, and we just got worn out. And the interesting thing was, so some younger people had it, and they changed its nature, and they took off the independent voice of the visual arts, and they got a big donation from a major collector in Chicago. So and they thought they could compete with the New York magazines by being facsimiles, and it lasted 1 year after we left and blew vast amounts of money.
Wow. One whole year, huh?
Yeah, they didn't understand.
No, no, it sounds like it was totally,
they didn't get it. Yeah, they didn't understand.
Yeah. While you were doing this magazine, the evolution or devolution of the art world during your publication of the magazine, did you see vast changes take place?
Well, I saw the beginning of the change, and you see, Chicago, for its own reasons, and I don't knock it, because I do think there were some excellent Chicago artists. And we were set against the artists, which is not true.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like what you're doing.
No, but that was the setup. But yeah, the point was that there are certain Chicago Images artists who I think are very, very important.
Uh-huh.
However, the point is that Chicago got into vernacular art. It got into kitsch, and it was trying to make high art out of kitsch. Now, that's what Chicago does. Now, the same thing happened in Baltimore with John Walters and Pink Flamingos.
The
art scene in New York today with Jeff Koons is a fulfillment of those tendencies that were started in the regions where New York was being all intellectual, and New York art historians were deciding what the avant-garde was. So this art was vernacular and against the so-called avant-garde. Okay.
Right.
So what I think, I think in a way that that the managing of art today, i.e. the museums, and the fact there's no criticism, I think it's run into dead ground. And Koons is the most richest artist in America, and Damien Hirst is equivalent to
London. That's what I meant by sad earlier when
I
said
to you. Yes, it is sad.
That's what I meant.
Yeah. It's sad for Damien Hirst, too, but you see...
But for you, I mean.
Well, no, it's not. Well, it is sad, but it's not sad. And the reason is, I was born in 1936, and I lived in regional England, and there was a cultural lag then. So the culture of the academy was... I was at the end of the culture of the academy. Mm-hmm. Now, the academy was sentimental and kitsch and degenerate. It happened to be Victorian.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is the time when greeting cards were invented. And so I was exposed to the original Hallmark greeting cards.
Right.
So I am very lucky to know the Academy was populist art.
Right.
Now, most people think of it as being an elite art, but it wasn't. It was the biggest art fair in the world.
Right.
Now, it was on different levels, and you could choose your level. So I am so lucky to have been aware of an art form that got to be degenerate because it responded to the populist market.
Right.
I am so privileged to have that.
Do you think the avant-garde lives on in the way that you want it to live on? It just has no... There's no criticism of it.
No. There has to be courage and incredible act of imagination.
Mm-hmm. Well, guess what we're out of?
Okay.
We're out of time. But thank you, Derek, for talking with us today. And thank you, folks, for listening. We hope to see you on the radio again next Friday at 12:30. This is Tim Bowring. You're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's Indie Radio. It's radio for the rest of us. And thanks again. That was fascinating. I wish we had much, much more time.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.